Thanks, Erin, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this presentation today about the new statutory rule governing OTC drugs. The presentation topics today are going to involve how the CARES Act changed the OTC drug monograph review process, the administrative order process for drugs that has been created now by the CARES Act, opportunities and pathways for development of novel technologies, including new OTC dosage forms, and a COVID-19 connection to this information. So our first topic is how the CARES Act changed the monograph review process. And Erin, you can advance those slides. We're not going to go into the history of the OTC monograph review process today, but I do have a slide that briefly describes what has gone on before in order to level set all of those who are in the audience and to help us explore how significant it is that this new administrative order process has been created by Congress. The prior OTC drug monograph process involved drugs that could be marketed without FDA approval if they met the conditions of an OTC monograph. They did not have to be pre-approved by FDA or go through the new drug approval process. They were identified with active ingredients and certain strengths, divided into 26 therapeutic categories, for example, antihistamines, laxatives, sunscreens, that could be self-treated without a doctor's involvement. And some of the OTC drug categories had subcategories. For example, the category oral health care included subcategories of toothache relief, anti-gingivitis, anti-plaque. The OTC monograph review specified routes of administration that could be sold through this direct-to-market process. For example, the cough-cold monograph specified oral administration, and the acne monograph specified topical administration. Dosage forms, however, were usually not specified. They were left unstated. So if you were trying to market a drug under a monograph that required oral administration, each drug manufacturer could decide whether to make that formulation into a tablet, a capsule, a liquid, a lozenge, or other legitimate oral form. Similarly, if your monograph specified topical administration, then that you could choose a lotion, a cream, an ointment, et cetera. FDA did, however, refer to dosage forms and products that were existing in the market on or before inception of the OTC drug review, and that took place in 1972. So in FDA's mind, to some extent, the dosage forms that were available for direct to market as OTC drugs were limited to the dosage forms that existed at that time in history. And then the OTC monograph review process, FDA categorized these ingredients and routes of administration into categories to describe the legal authority under which they could be marketed, and those were category one for generally recognized as safe and effective for the claimed therapeutic indication, or GRAS E, as we use the acronym, or they were identified as category two, which was not generally recognized as safe and effective and could not be marketed under the OTC monograph system. And then category three were the products that had insufficient data available to FDA so the agency could not determine if they were safe and effective. And so those were left in sort of a pending Category 3 situation. Next slide. Here's another presentation of how FDA went through the monograph review process, which started in the 1970s and has been going all the way through to 2020. Step one was a review panel meeting where the panel met to categorize OTC drugs based on their type and safety and efficacy. Step two, they would issue an advance notice of proposed rulemaking to describe which ingredients, which strengths, which routes of administration could be marketed under particular therapeutic categories. And they opened a comment process for the public to give information back to FDA about those ingredients and products. Step three, FDA would issue a tentative final monograph, which was a proposed rule, and open that up again for public comment, which was step four. And then eventually, as step five, FDA would finalize its rule after taking into consideration all of the industries or the public's comments. They would codify that rule in the Code of Federal Regulations at Part 300, and that would be the documentation that companies would look to when they decided how to formulate their particular products for particular therapeutic categories. Often this process, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, took an extended amount of time and added on extra TFMs throughout the years to make sure that all comments were considered appropriately. And the impetus for this change in the law that we saw in March 2020 was that the time period between number 4 and number 5 on this slide lagged substantially, often for decades. So FDA was just not able to work through the finalization of these OTC monographs in a timely fashion. And some TFMs are still pending today. Next slide. So under the new legislation, FDA now can allow changes to existing OTC monograph drugs by issuing administrative orders instead of the former Federal Register notice and comment process. So the process now is that FDA will issue these orders at its own initiative or at the request of any member of the industry. Full notice and comment rulemaking will not be available, but you'll still have some due process and an appeals process that we'll be discussing later on in this presentation. The intended implications for this new statute is the hope that it would take less time and money and resources for FDA to make changes to OTC monographs and the drugs subject to those monographs. In turn, that would allow OTC monograph drugs to be marketed, hopefully, faster and in an easier mechanism, where there's not any need for oversight by the Office of Management and Budget that governs Federal Register publications or the use of the publication process. And we'll be exploring today whether this administrative order process will actually be faster or not, remains to be seen. Next slide. So the CARES Act that was passed in March, in subtitle F, added a new section called Section 505G to the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. And this reformed the OTC monograph system in several other key ways, such as providing an exclusivity period for marketing, the requirement for user fees, and it has an impact on the regulatory status of monographs. Next slide. Briefly, the exclusivity period in the monograph system previously is that there was no market exclusivity for OTC monograph drugs. Anyone could market their version of an OTC product or copy a competitor's version, and that's why we see many store brands when we look in the stores today. You may have a branded product, a generic looking product, and a CVS product, all generally providing the same ingredients for the same indications of use. Under the CARES Act, however, we have a possibility for obtaining 18 months of exclusivity for new active ingredients or changes in conditions for use if human data studies are presented to FDA and deemed essential to the issuance of a new administrative order. Exclusivity is not available for Tier 2 changes, safety updates, new testing methods, or minor changes. Next slide. Under the user fee program, previously there were no user fees that were collected from the OTC drug industry. However, now the industry will be required to pay annual facility fees as well as one-time user fees for over-the-counter monograph order requests. That will be beginning in fiscal year 2021. FDA was supposed to issue, publish those fee amounts as of May 11th, according to the statute, but we have not seen that come through yet. And these user fees will fund FDA's continued review of OTC drug ingredients. If you don't pay your user fee, there will be consequences for that. FDA will issue a public listing of people in arrears. They could deem any of your outstanding requests to be incomplete, and your product would be misbranded. Next slide. So how did this, act change the existing monograph categories? Here's a slide that explains how the current categories will be treated. Any drug ingredient that is identified as a Category 1 safe and effective ingredient is deemed to be not a new drug so long as all applicable conditions are met for OTC regulations, and those can be marketed direct to market as OTC drugs just as we do today. Any Category 2 unsafe or ineffective drugs under the monograph system are automatically deemed to be a new drug, which is, again, the same as things stand today. And for the Category 3 products, you may remember that I stated that those were sort of in a pending category for FDA to finalize those once they determined whether they had enough data to support the safety or effectiveness of those particular products. So Category 3 products will be allowed to continue marketing after the passage of this new legislation, pending a further FDA order in accord with the Act. So again, we'll be waiting for FDA to take some action against Category 3 products, and they can remain in the market until FDA does so. There are just a few OTC drugs on the market that don't seem to fall within any of those three categories. And for those, the statute says they're deemed new drugs and they're subject to FDA's new drug approval process. If they remain in the market, they'll be considered misbranded and they'll be subject to FDA enforcement. Next slide. How does the CARES Act administrative order provision affect pending monographs? Well, existing monographs today are converted to these new administrative orders under the statute. Tentative final monographs are also considered to be final administrative orders. They don't need further FDA action. However, for TSM ingredients, where FDA had previously said more data is needed, or category three, those remain pending. They can be marketed until FDA takes further action. And for products that are subject to an advance notice of proposed rulemaking where there had not been a subsequent TFM, so if the most recent Federal Register notice that covers your product is an ANPR, then for those, Category 1 ingredients remain pending, but Category 3 are treated as unapproved new drugs. And for ingredients found not Grafton E in a TFM or ANPR, they have 6 months from enactment before they are unapproved new drugs. And there's a separate rule for sunscreen products. And now I will ask my colleague, Ann Begley, to continue with the presentation.
Thank you, Rebecca. And I think I have control now, or Erin, I think you might be giving me control of the slides, correct? Or otherwise, Erin, just if you could go to the next. Oh, great. Thank you. So Rebecca did a great job of expressing or explaining how the Act changes from the existing requirements. And it's really important to understand now how the process will work for companies that are interested in submitting an order request for a change in a monograph. And so we're going to go through that. Obviously, at a high level, we could spend hours on this, but we'll try to give you a basic overview so that gives you an idea of next steps. Okay, let's see. There we go. Okay, so first slide here that I'm going to discuss is what Rebecca has already explained. The administrative order process allows for two types of orders. There are FDA-initiated orders and requester-initiated orders. And when we talk about the requester, we're talking about sponsors, companies, industry that have an interest in either modifying an order or seeing a monograph completed. And we'll go into some more detail on that. When one looks at the statute, however, it's really a skeleton of what the process will look like. Lots of questions will remain unanswered until FDA creates the program through guidance or through orders in some context. However, this legislation has really been floating around for a number of years. And in fact, it was expected to some extent to be implemented back in 2018. And at that time, the FDA, understanding and believing that it may go into effect, had actually developed a program to implement the OTC monograph drug reform program and issued this document that's referenced here, the OTC monograph user fee program performance goals and procedures document that was supposed to specify what would happen between 2018 and 2022, suggesting basically a 5-year ramp up for the program. And it's helpful to look at this document because it gives us clues of what to expect where there are holes in what the statute specifies. So looking now at the CARES Act itself, here is a brief overview of what it would look like when FDA initiates an administrative order process. Now, again, either FDA or a requester can initiate the administrative order process. FDA typically would be doing this either to finalize a monograph, for example, a pending Category 3 ingredient, moving it forward either as a GRAS E substance, or making a determination that it is not a GRAS E substance. It also may issue or amend existing orders to add safety information or to change other aspects of the monograph. And so this would be a situation where FDA would initiate an administrative order process. If the impact would impact a sponsor's product or ability to market the product, FDA is required to notify sponsors at least 2 days before issuance of the proposed order. In other words, they're supposed to make their best efforts. Obviously, if it's not possible to notify for reasons of lack of access to that sponsor, no notice may occur, but there needs to be some attempt to notify the sponsor before issuance of a proposed order to be generated. Once that order is issued, it is published on FDA's website and in the Federal Register notice. And again, that's very much in the statute. It's required to be in both places. The goal is that nobody misses it when it is published. But there is no time frame for when this might be issued. And that becomes more pertinent when we start thinking about the requester initiated administrative order process. After it's published, the public will have 45 days generally to comment on the proposed order. There is an exception if FDA is issuing an order suggesting that an ingredient is not grass, which would mean that would need to be taken off the market, then the comment period would be 180 days. There are exceptions here in terms of the 45-day time period. If the comments are substantial, that may be extended. But the typical expected time frame, again, when it's not a not grass determination, will be a 45-day comment period. After some time thereafter, FDA will then issue a final order. It will be published in the Federal Register. And time will be provided for sponsors to request a dispute resolution process. Again, as with the proposed administrative order, the time to issue a final order is not specified in the CARES Act. There is no requirement in the CARES Act that the FDA issue that final order at any time following the comment period. However, assuming that they do and, you know, that it is issued, that's the goal of this process, there is a dispute resolution process, which would take would go all up to as high as, in terms of the dispute resolution process, to the director of CDER. If a sponsor or requester wishes to appeal a final order, they have 45 days from the time that the final order is issued. And then within that time frame, the initial appeal can occur within 45 days, but there may be opportunities for additional appeals in that dispute resolution process that would subsequently not exceed 30 days. Assuming the dispute resolution process has been exhausted, the requester is opportunities for disputing the decision does not stop. There is an opportunity after this point for hearing, an administrative hearing. If a hearing is requested, it's only available for sponsors who participated in a final stage of dispute resolution. So in other words, the hearing will not be available if a party does not initiate a dispute resolution process within the 45-day time frame following the final order issuance. FDA may deny a hearing for sponsors who do not submit human or non-human data studies relevant to their drug safety or effectiveness. So again, this is looking to some extent at the requester-initiated hearing process, but there are situations where FDA can deny a hearing. Once the hearing process is complete and a decision is final, it will not take effect until the requester has an opportunity to seek judicial review. Judicial review is provided for in U.S. District Court, very much like the process if an NDA application is denied or withdrawn. The difference being that if it's a new drug, the case would be brought at the appellate level, and the statute is very specific that in this case, for judicial review, it will start at the district court level. The matter must be brought for judicial review within 60 days of either a final order, hearing denial, or a hearing decision, whichever is later. Now, what that means is if you go back to the final order, a requester can go straight to district court. They do not need to go through the dispute resolution process or go through the hearing process. So there are multiple mechanisms for the requester to seek judicial review of a decision. But ultimately, from the final review or the final order, they can go straight to judicial review. And that's important to know because that's certainly something that requesters will need to consider in terms of the importance of the process and how fast they want to move it forward to a final review or final order. So now we're going to look briefly at requester-initiated submission process. And this is just a very high-level summary, and we'll go into a little bit more detail in the next couple of slides. Sponsors will submit a request for an industry-initiated administrative order. The FDA will then make a filing determination based on that slide that we looked at previously. Again, there's no time frame associated with the issuance of the proposed administrative order, which is step three. And then there would be a comment period under that process. And then once that is concluded, a final order will be issued and become effective, again, assuming judicial review or all other options of review have been exhausted. So what happens initially when one submits a request, an OTC monograph order request or OMOR to the FDA? FDA needs to make a determination of whether the request itself is sufficient, and there will be, what will be sufficient remains to be seen. We'll see that in another slide because we do not yet know what an OMOR request will look like. If FDA determines that the OMOR is sufficient, it will file a request and it begin the process of issuing a proposed order and then go through this process that's outlined on the left of your screen. If FDA, on the other hand, determines that the submission is insufficient, there are two ways that the requester can address the situation. Number one, they can demand that the request be filed by FDA and that FDA initiate a review proceeding, in which case the FDA would then be required to move through the process of issuing a proposed order and going through that process. Assuming that FDA had issues with the request, it would be expected that the outcome would be negative, but the goal of the party in that case, of course, is to remove that process towards a final decision if there is a decision to go through the dispute resolution hearing and judicial review decision. The other alternative is for the requester to withdraw the request. And then finally, the secretary can deny a request for review under this process if it makes a case for the fact that the information provided is inadequate for a GRAS determination, a generally recognized as safe and effective determination. So some of the key takeaways that we should think about here in terms of this process. Number one is without specific timeframes to issue a proposed and final order, dispute resolution and judicial hearing, it's hard to know whether the administrative order process will be faster for new OTC drugs to come to market. Much of it will depend on FDA's willingness and priorities and honestly resources. So again, it is to be determined. However, looking at the goals letter, and I jumped ahead, I'll come back to this in a second. Looking at the goals letter, there appear to be opportunities or interest to move this process through in a more reasonable fashion. For example, the time to decide in the performance goals letter, the FDA has identified a time to decide whether to file an OMOR as 60 days. The time to issue a proposed order as 12 months to issue a proposed tier one order and 10 months for a tier two orders. Length of the comment period is the same, 45 days, which can be extended in the performance gold letter, 45 days also in the CARES Act. opportunity to extend that comment period is anticipated in the goals document. No time frame is identified in the CARES Act. And in issuance of a final order, FDA anticipates 17.5 months for a Tier 1 condition, and we'll discuss Tier 1 in just a couple of minutes, and Tier 2 conditions would result in about a 15.5-month time frame. But keep in mind here that because this is not a statutory requirement, FDA is not tied to these performance goals, and it will depend on resources and so forth. And so this just brings us back to whether the new process will be actually faster, and comparing it to the TEA time and extent application process and the new drug application process. I'm going to start from the right and move over to the left because we've already talked about the OMOR. Obviously, the new drug application is quite expensive, and the process to get to the last bullet point, file the NDA with CDER, can be quite extensive in terms of the years of data collection and studies that need to go on during that time period. But at the point that the product is filed, an application is filed, there is a designated 10-month review period. So conclusion is going to occur. Obviously, if there's a supplement or amendment to the application, there may be some stops of that 10-month review period, but it's pretty much set in stone. So very expensive, but there is a circumscribed time frame for review. The time and extent application was fairly limited, really focusing on ingredients that have been marketed for many years, and so that process really does not have the availability or the expansiveness that the OMAR process does. But looking at the TEA process, similarly, no time frames were identified for completion of a final rule in that case. That was the time and extent application process. It's under 21 CFR 330, it allowed for updates of the monograph regulations. Now, this process no longer exists, but the TEA was intended as a process to get new ingredients into the monograph, and frankly, it has been ineffective because the timeframes were not available for bringing those products to market. And again, we won't go through the OMOR process. Again, we've discussed the lack of timelines, which creates problems and uncertainty as to whether this process will be faster. So what is the information that will be required by the GRAS determination by administrative order? Again, to be determined. The CARES Act does not explicitly describe the content and format requirements. In fact, the statute itself states that FDA will issue guidance on this topic, so at some point we should expect to see guidance. FDA, again, going back to the performance goals document, anticipated the need to draft guidance on this process and stated that it would likely follow the non-prescription sunscreen drug products format and content of data submissions guidance document that it issued back in 2016. So this is a good place to look if you're wanting to understand what that OMOR application will look like. Essentially, the expectation we believe will be that FDA will expect that it follows the common technical document format, that there would be an administrative section, a summary section, a section for relevant quality information and manufacturing information, a section for non-clinical data, and a section for clinical data. So it will look very much like what we think of in terms of a new drug application. The extent of data will be what will be of interest in terms of FDA future guidance. Now, you've heard us talk about Tier 1 and Tier 2 changes. Essentially, Tier 2 changes are specified as minor or small changes by the agency, and those would be the type of changes that are associated with minor changes to the drug facts panel, like reordering of information, standardization of doses, additions to other information sections, for example, storage conditions, and indeed anything that FDA identifies as a Tier 2 minor change. So that is a small subset And then the CARES Act itself, if you look to the right, all innovation OMORs that do not fit the definition of a Tier 2 are considered Tier 1 OMORs. So everything else is a Tier 1. If we look at the goals document, it gives an idea of the kind of Tier 1 innovations that we expect to see, new ingredients, new indications, both of which are discussed in the CARES Act, new combinations, test methods, new routes of administration, doses or concentrations. So Tier 1 are considered the more extensive changes, and so they would require more FDA review time. Tier 2 are those that are considered smaller changes. It is expected that most changes would have to go through the OMOR process. Now, we talked about clinical data in terms of an OMOR application. There may be circumstances where a new active ingredient may actually be the subject of an OMOR approval, even where there is no clinical data submitted. And there are two circumstances. One, where there's a verifiable history of being marketed and safely used by consumers in the U.S. as a non-prescription drug under comparable conditions of use. And that would be a decision by FDA that it's been in the market for a long enough time to establish that the ingredient itself is safe. And so, and there's some indication that it is effective. And so FDA would not require an OMOR to be submitted in that case, or would not require data associated with that OMOR. The other situation is where that ingredient has been marketed in another country, and specifically in a listed country. And when we refer to listed countries, we're referring to those countries that FDA recognizes their regulatory oversight as similar to the oversight that FDA has over drugs in the U.S. And so we're really generally talking about many countries that have similar process in Europe, in China, in India, et cetera. In those cases, FDA would need to set forth conditions that would identify what period of time is necessary to provide assurance of safe use as a non-prescription drug. And FDA would expect that that drug has been the subject of adequate monitoring by a regulatory body deemed acceptable, including adverse event monitoring. So there would be some level of assurance, or there would be significant level of assurance to the FDA that the drug product itself marketed in other countries has been the subject of adequate review and monitoring. One aspect of interest, and as I said, FDA's expectation and the CARES Act expectation is that most changes will be going through an OMOR of some kind, is a certain minor changes, and specifically the statute refers to minor dosage form changes. That's the only change that the CARES Act refers to as not possibly not requiring an OMOR, meaning the company can go to market with a new dosage, as long as it can be determined to a dosage form that does not affect the safety or effectiveness of the drug and will not materially affect the extent of absorption or other exposure to the active ingredient. So in order to make this determination, a sponsor would need to follow conditions that FDA has set forth in an order that sets forth the conditions under which a dosage form can meet these requirements. That needs to occur, and until that occurs, we won't know the circumstances under which FDA will accept a minor dosage form change. Now, in the meantime, it should be understood that even while the sponsor can make this self-determination following an FDA order that describes how that determination can be made, that FDA can still request that information at a later time. It may not be submitted to the agency, but it can be requested by the agency to be submitted at a later time. Okay, so one thing of interest in terms of data submitted to the agency is what is publicly available. And those who are using this process need to understand that because it will be determined to be generally recognized as safe, pretty much all the data that's submitted should be the type of data that can be made publicly available, because the idea of general recognition of safety is that it's generally recognized by scientists in the field in the community. And so it's something that a group of scientists can get together and make a determination of GRAS E. And so one in submitting an OMOR should not expect a lot of confidential data to be submitted or to be not disclosable by the agency in making a decision. There are a couple of areas where FDA will allow certain information to be withheld as confidential, and these are identified in the attached slide. But one of particular interest, if the submitter withdraws the request, then all of the data will be deemed confidential. It's important to know that this is a process that will take some time for FDA to build up. There are performance goals that are that are set forth, building necessary infrastructure. When FDA issued its goals document, it indicated a 5-year growth or infrastructure buildup. And so we should not expect this to be implemented overnight. We should be looking at a process where FDA expects to slowly but surely meet the objectives of the goals letter over the next 5 years. In fact, at the time that FDA published its letter in 2018, it believed that it was in a net negative situation in terms of capacity, meaning that it did not have the resources or the staffing to implement the expectations of the OMOR process. And so it does expect to complete its goals in fiscal year 4 and 5. So it's 2020 now. We should expect to see a process that's hopefully up and running by years 2024 and 2025. And with that, I turn it back over to Rebecca to discuss opportunities and pathways for introducing novel technologies, including new OTC drug dosage forms.
New dosage form that you think you want to bring to the marketplace, what are your opportunities? And Erin, you can advance that slide when you're ready. So the OMOR process, the statute specifically says that a requester can submit an OMOR to make the following changes: add a new ingredient to a monograph, add a new indication to an existing monograph ingredient, add a new combination of ingredients, or finalize one of those pending Category 3 TFM ingredients. If FDA has not initiated one, then the industry or a member of industry can initiate that on their own through an order request, and potentially add a novel dosage form to an existing monograph. And we have a question mark there and an asterisk, because the statute is a little bit unclear exactly where the novel dosage form will stand. In the section of the statute that describes the minor change process, it says that if you didn't follow the minor change process appropriately, or if FDA decided that your change was more than a minor change, that change would be subject to the NDA process. It didn't say that you could go back and start with the OMOR request. However, a different part of the statute says that all non-Tier 2 conditions of use are automatically Tier 1 innovations that are eligible for the OMOR process. And so it is a little bit unclear, and the performance goals document does not specify any further either how new dosage forms are to be handled. And so we're going to have to see what FDA does over the next couple of years as they develop this program. Next slide. So let's take a minute and talk about what is a new dosage form and what makes something novel. This is not defined in the CARES Act, so it, you know, FDA will have some discretion about how it defines a novel dosage form. If we look at the dosage forms that came into the marketplace over the last 20 years that were sort of, you know, new and interesting as compared to the inception of the program in 1972, companies have tried to sell OTC ingredients in oral beads. We have the oral films that melt on your tongue, different versions of analgesic patches. And those have, you know, some of them have been accepted by FDA over the years, and others FDA has taken enforcement action against and said they're not eligible for the OTC monograph system and need to go through new drug applications. So what new dosage forms do we think might be acceptable under this minor dosage form change that's allowed in the statute? Well, it, you know, we think it would be a continued consumer-related focus. So trying to help consumers understand an improvement in taste or convenience of the product, likability, able to, you know, help consumers comply with the dosing instructions. Those kinds of changes might be ones that FDA accepts as minor changes. And some examples that we've thought about are gummy type products, fast dissolving tablets, non-spill liquids are things that, you know, have been in the marketplace to some extent and may be permissible as minor changes. But in the future, you know, there's a lot of technologies that can be used to make novel dosage forms that potentially FDA and consumers haven't seen before, like nano droplets, buccal troches, maybe even oral inhalations. Next slide. So for those novel dosage forms that people will be creating and patenting over time, what are the possible pathways for OTC marketing? And we have them listed here on this slide. If they're already included in OTC monograph orders, then there wouldn't be any pathway that a manufacturer would have to take. The statute says that dosage forms that have existed for a material time and a material extent at the time of enactment of this new legislation are acceptable as OTC monograph drugs. So dosage forms are no longer directly tied to that 1972 date of the inception of the OTC drug review, and we're able to modernize some of the dosage forms that have been brought into the market over the last 20 to 30 years. Potentially, new dosage forms can come in under the minor change process, so long as that dosage form change does not affect safety, effectiveness, or absorption of the ingredient, and we'll go into that a little more in a second. You have the potential for the OMOR process. However, as I mentioned, we don't know for sure what FDA's expectation is here. Are they going to issue a guidance first? Do we need to see that guidance before we can start submitting OMORs for a new dosage form? And how much data will FDA be looking for to be included in that OMOR to support, you know, marketing of a novel dosage form? And, you know, we have no information from FDA on that topic. If you can't fit your dosage form into one of those three categories, then the default, of course, is the new drug application. So you need to think about, with respect to your dosage form, how novel is too novel? You know, if you're really extremely creative and have developed something new that FDA won't won't be familiar with the science, won't be familiar with how that dosage form interacts with the human body, it is very likely that FDA is going to say you need to submit a new drug application in order to have that reviewed in a pre-approval process. Next slide. So if we step back for a moment and talk about the minor dosage form changes, there are two steps that a company could go through if it believes that the dosage form change it wants to make is sort of simple enough to qualify as a minor change. So without needing FDA approval or an OMOR, you would have to show that the change will not affect the safety, the effectiveness of the drug, and will not materially affect its absorption or the exposure to the active ingredient in the body. Then FDA will issue an administrative order specifying requirements for determining minor dosage form changes in comparison to a suitable reference product. So the agency will give us a sense at some point in the future of what minor changes would be acceptable. And the guidance will consider public standards and standard practices for evaluating quality of drugs. Manufacturers may also continue to make changes that clearly fall within a monograph outside of the minor dosage form process. So if the monograph already permitted a lozenge, for example, in the cough cold space, clearly, lozenges can continue to be utilized. And now back to Anne.
Reform and the CARES Act, right? I mean, you know, most of the CARES Act is really focused on the situation that we find ourselves in now. And so it was somewhat of a surprise to see the proposed legislation that has been many years old in terms of OTC drug reform. Well, there were folks who were having trouble advancing, my apologies. There we go. There were congressmen and leaders who suggested that it was important to have OTC drug reform. And specifically, there is just one quote where Congressman Leda said, "The CARES Act also includes a bill that I've long championed that will make it easier for Americans to protect themselves against COVID-19 by reforming and modernizing the way over-the-counter products are approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration." Now, of course, we all know that this is not carte blanche to start making COVID-19 treatment claims. And in fact, FDA has issued several warning letters on this front for a number of product categories, including a HEPA air purifier, certain Chinese medicine products, as well as vitamin C's. But indeed, on this next slide that we discuss, FDA issued a warning letter to a company marketing a hand sanitizer that's currently subject to Category 3 in a TFM. And FDA was very clear to say that the product under the CARES Act can be marketed without approval as a Category 3 ingredient if they meet the requirements set forth in the Act, but because of the claims related to COVID-19, the FDA found that it was not consistent with the TFM for that particular product, and therefore it was outside the bounds and was considered an unapproved new drug under Section 505. So it's important to keep that in mind, that while the CARES Act has changed the status of Category 3 ingredients, in other words, now they can be marketed until FDA issues an administrative order making any changes, they must be in line with the CARES Act requirements. In terms of another aspect of COVID-19 to think about in the OTC space generally, FDA has indicated that, I shouldn't say FDA, Congress as well as the FTC, and there are even state law bills, assuring that price gouging doesn't take place in connection with COVID, with OTC-type products. For example, the FTC commissioner has stated that it will not tolerate businesses seeking to take advantage of consumers' concerns and fears regarding COVID-19. Congress introduced, as we all know, the Price Gouging Act, in which Senator Warren said, "We can't let American families be squeezed even further by companies out to make a quick buck." And even the New York State legislature has issued a price gouging threshold that includes items such as hand sanitizers and other over-the-counter medications. So, So the takeaways from this program, and we hope that this has been helpful to you, it's, again, a high-level overview of a very complicated and new provision in the Act, but the goals of the administrative order process under the CARES Act is to streamline the OTC drug marketing process, and there's still going to be a multi-step process, so it's not going to be, it may be streamlined, that is the hope, it may be quicker, that is the hope, but there will be a process that needs to be undertaken, and it will only be as fast as FDA has believes it has the capacity to move, hopefully in line with its goals document. It will be over the next 4 years. Again, there are many unknowns. Until FDA issues a guidance, questions will remain unanswered. However, based on FDA's goal statements, it seems that FDA expects to get this implemented, as we said, in the next couple of years. Finally, there are questions on the scope of minor dosage form changes because of the way the statute is written. Is the OMOR process available? If not, it may be the situation where it's either a minor change and the next default is a new drug application. So with that, that concludes our formal presentation. If anyone has any questions, Rebecca and I would be pleased to answer them. This program, as Aaron mentioned, will be available as well as the slides in 48 hours. And so we thank you for your time.